were started by an ex-MI6 operative, and they were backed by millions of dollars from Britain and from Canada and from America in order to promote the propaganda that they were using around chemical warfare and the barrel bombs that were just supposed to destroy hospitals in Syria. So, if I had the money, I wouldn't go and fight my enemy. I'd probably pay someone else to do it and keep myself safe.
Okay, so the final question goes to you, Dalla Kovalik. Iran has always said that, when you have foreign countries and their armies in one form or another in this particular region of West Asia, and this is in direct reference to the U.S., that you're going to have these types of activities still prosper in some sense, or still to ongo, to continue, that is. And of course, the association that we have made in this program of the U.S. with the Daesh terrorists is still one source of instability, which Iran says that the U.S. needs to go. Are we looking at the fact that if the U.S. was to leave the region, that these terrorists would cease to exist?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the sad part, the sad truth is that once you create such monsters, they tend to have a life of their own. We saw that again with the Mujahideen, which morphed into Al-Qaeda, which then went on to attack the United States. I don't think that was the plan. I mean, there's a lot of unintended consequences from all this. Now, you'd hope that eventually those things would fizzle out. But again, the U.S. has created monsters that it set loose on the world. And once that happens, it may be hard to control and stop them. And that, again, that is one of the great tragedies of all this.
Thank you very much for that. Daniel Kovalik, Professor of International Human Rights, University of Pittsburgh School of Law from Pittsburgh, PA. Farah Hughes, thank you. Journalist, author, and activist from Belfast. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tatway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 2 to 4 of Surah Nahl, recited by Murtaza Rahnema.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Yunazzilul malaa'ikata bir-ruhi min amrihi على من يشاء من عباده أن أنذروا أنه لا إله إلا أنا فاتقون خلق السماوات والأرض بالحق تعالى عما يشركون خلق الإنسان من نطفة فإذا هو خصيم مبين
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Tehran warns of a possible pullout from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty or expelling international nuclear inspectors if Europe decides to blacklist the IRGC. Brazil and Argentina announced a plan to develop a common currency in order to reduce the two countries' reliance on the US dollar. The U.S. police say a man who shot dead 10 people in the state of California killed himself after hours of manhunt. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, top Iranian officials have strongly condemned the European Parliament's call for blacklisting the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, warning the EU of reciprocal measures. President Ibrahim Raisi says enemies are trying to subject a large part of the ruling system in Iran to criticism due to its successes. But to no avail. Also, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian warning that all options against the EU are on the table. He said Tehran would consider withdrawal from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty or expulsion of international nuclear inspectors if the EU remains on its wrong course. That statement was echoed in Parliament, where MPs called for a decisive response and retaliatory measures against the armed forces of European countries. EU foreign ministers are set to discuss tightening sanctions on Iran next week. Earlier, political analyst Fouad Izadi joined us with his take on the rising Iranophobia in Europe.
You know, normal people, when they fail at a project or a policy, they generally go back and try to make corrections, learn from the past mistakes, and have an action or a policy that is more reasonable. That's what normal people do, normal countries do that. And then you have some people occasionally that when they fail, they start swearing, they start chanting stuff that is not appropriate. And the second category of people are generally, they get upset because of the failure and they start saying nonsense. And it seems Europeans are in the second category, at least the people who voted for this motion are, instead of learning from past mistakes, instead of realizing that they cannot overthrow the Iranian government, they start name-calling, they start engaging in activities that are against international law, and they're going to hurt themselves. You know, they got into a fight with the Russian government, and they are not able to use Russian energy resources. If they want to repeat that with the Iranian government, they will be cut off from Middle Eastern energy sources. That is not good for people in Europe.
Now, Afghanistan is experiencing an exceptionally cold winter amid a severe economic crisis and major aid cuts in recent weeks. The volatile situation has put the lives of many in danger. Press TV's Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
Afghanistan is witnessing its coldest winter in 15 years, adding to the misery of millions who are already struggling with multiple crises. Umar Khan, a Kabul resident and a father of seven, lives in a cold shack. Two of his children are severely sick. Without a job and relief assistance, he has been unable to afford food, heating, and medication for his family. The situation has triggered fears of human losses.
As I told you, this son of mine collects plastic bottles and waste for one-time heating during the day. I was unemployed almost the entire year, and I couldn't afford fuel or winter clothes for my children. This other son is suffering from the disease of kidney stones. In such a situation, I'm afraid my children may go undernourished or freeze to death. This is a catastrophic moment, and I'm wondering what to do.
Meanwhile, the United Nations has put Afghanistan on its list of 11 crisis hotspots in 2023. The UN survey shows that two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, over 28 million people, need humanitarian aid. Heads of households, like Shah Gul, say they can't cope with the harsh winter alone.
We can't afford more than one meal per day. We used to buy some loaves of bread and potatoes, but today they're also gone from the table. We're not living a life in this cold room with no blanket or enough clothes. When the Taliban took power, everyone was saying that Afghanistan is going to see peace. But what about jobs, earning an income and food? We need the Taliban administration and aid groups to reach out to us before we die from hunger or cold.
This comes as major aid groups have suspended their missions following the Taliban's ban on female workers. For many Afghans, the services provided by the NGOs were a lifeline that has been removed at the worst possible moment. Afghanistan is grappling with economic, political, and human rights crisis. Experts said the Taliban administration's restrictive measures, coupled with Western sanctions, are worsening the situation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Moving on now, Brazil and Argentina are planning for greater economic integration, including a common currency which would wean off a reliance on the U.S. dollar in bilateral transactions. Brazil's President Lula da Silva and his Argentine counterpart Alberto Fernandez made the revelation in a joint article they penned together. The text says Brasilia and Buenos Aires want to eliminate barriers to their exchanges and encourage the use of local currencies. The two countries have also decided to speed up discussions on a common South American currency aimed at boosting regional trade. Lula had brought up the idea of a common currency during his presidential campaign. He has chosen Argentina for his first trip abroad since he took office. Relations between Brasilia and Buenos Aires were tense during Brazil's former right-wing president Jair Bolsonaro. a man who went on a shooting rampage and killed 10 people during the Chinese Lunar New Year celebrations in the U.S. state of California, has been found dead. Police say they found the body of the shooter after hours of manhunt. They say the suspect, identified as 72-year-old Hu Can Tran, died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. His body was inside a van in a city about 35 kilometers away from the site of the shooting in Monterey, that is, Park, which is home to a large Asian community. The investigation is still underway to determine the motive behind the carnage. The incident, which also injured 10 people, is the latest in the grim litany of mass shootings in the U.S. Over the past years, there have been growing calls for passing stricter legislation on gun control and curtailing access to weapons in the country. Germany says it is ready to authorize Poland to send German-made Leopard tanks to Ukraine to help Kiev fight Russian forces if Warsaw makes such a request. Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said Berlin will not stand in the way if it is asked the question. She said Germany is also discussing with its partners whether to supply those tanks. Meanwhile, the French president did not rule out the possibility of supplying Kiev with Leclerc tanks. Emmanuel Macron said, however, that sending tanks must not escalate the situation. New developments come as Western nations remain divided over supplying Ukraine with main battle tanks. Germany had linked its stance on Leopards to U.S. reluctance to transfer its own Abrams tanks. And Russia has repeatedly warned that the West's military aid to Ukraine will only prolong the war. Almost 1 year into the war in Ukraine, and there seems to be no diplomatic solution to the deadly conflict. The situation is exacerbating even further, given the rift among Western countries on how to assist Kiev militarily. The question is if such divisions would grow considerably and finally lead to an even bigger confrontation.
Fractures are appearing in the Ukraine conflict between the Western backers of the war, first amongst themselves, then with Ukraine. Even though some 50 nations agreed to provide Kyiv with billions of dollars worth of military hardware, including armored vehicle and munitions needed to push back Russian forces, Germany has refused to provide Ukraine with Leopard tanks. Not only that, it has prevented other nations from transferring these tanks to Ukraine by countries that have them in their possession. The new German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius said that despite heightened expectations, we still cannot say when a decision will be taken and what the decision will be when it comes to the Leopard tanks. This has angered Ukraine, which blasted the global indecision of its allies after Germany's refusal. A Ukrainian presidential advisor tweeted, "Today's indecision is killing more of our people. Every day of delay is the death of Ukrainians. Think faster." It appears that the main disagreement lies between the U.S. and Germany, which has indicated that it would agree to do so only if the U.S. provided its Abrams tanks as well. Washington has said providing its Abrams tanks to Ukraine is not feasible, citing difficulties in training and maintenance. This disagreement has led to friction within the circle of U.S. congressmen. U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has called on both countries to supply the machines. To the Germans, he said send the tanks to Ukraine because they need them. It is in your national interest that Russian President Vladimir Putin loses in Ukraine. To the U.S. President Joe Biden administration, he said send American tanks so that others will follow our lead.
Well, the growing division among countries in the West brings to the spotlight the fact that each and every one of those countries are seeking their own political agenda by arming Kiev. If that's the case, would people in Ukraine finally get to realize that their country is being used as an instrument for other nations' anti-Russia goals?
Military assistance to Ukraine has continued unabated in recent weeks and months. The headline reads, Europe is gearing up to send Western tanks to Ukraine. It almost sounds like the warring parties are just getting warmed up to the conflict, that the war has entered a new phase. One conclusion could be that Ukraine is losing the war on the ground since it continues to seek more military assistance and what it has received so far has not been enough to defeat the Russian forces. This, however, will not deter NATO and a number of individual member states who have pledged to provide heavier weapons to Ukraine. U.S.'s cautious stance may be that it does not want to fall into a direct conflict with Russia. That could also mean that it may risk defeat or that this risks getting into a nuclear confrontation. Russia's reaction to countries that are going to provide Ukraine with tanks was a warning. Dmitry Medvedev, deputy chairman of the Security Council of the Russian Federation, has said Kiev's foreign backers do not care about Ukrainian lives and are motivated by their desire to hurt Russia. Those tanks can burn and will burn like the rest of the weapons. The nations supplying them are using Ukraine as an instrument in achieving their anti-Russian goals. Russia has also stated that this is no longer a war between Russia and Ukraine, but a war between Russia and US and NATO. But what the Ukrainian defense minister said has been very telling. He tweeted recently, "We are carrying out NATO's mission today. They aren't shedding their blood. We are shedding ours. That's why they are required to supply us with weapons." All that brings everyone to the question, when will Ukrainians realize their country is being sacrificed for the sake of the US weakening Russia?
That wraps up the International Bulletin for this hour.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Imam Baqir's blessed birthday and Rajab first. In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and heartiest felicitations to you on the advent of the auspicious month of Rajab and the blessed birthday of a very noble person whose teachings continue to guide the faithful despite the passing of a millennium and almost four centuries. Please stay with us for a special program on this occasion. Rajab is the great month of Allah. No other month equals it in sanctity and merit. During this month, fighting against the infidels is prohibited. Surely whoever fasts a day of Rajab secures Allah's greatest pleasure, distances himself or herself from Allah's wrath, and one of the gates of hell is closed for him. These are the remarks of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, on the first of the four sacred months of the Islamic calendar, in which divine mercy opens its gates. He also said, God Almighty grants the reward of 100,000 good deeds to those who recite La ilaha illallah, meaning no God but Allah, 1,000 times during Rajab, and shall build for them 100 cities in paradise. On the first of this sacred month, the Prophet's namesake and fifth divinely designated heir, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, was born in Medina in the year 57 AH, corresponding to 676 AD. It's interesting to note that the Seal of Messengers had prophesied his great-great-grandson as Baqir al-Ulum, or splitter and spreader of sciences, and sent his greetings through his loyal disciple, Jabir ibn Abdullah Ansari, over half a century earlier, in order to guide the seekers of truth of the subsequent generations. Thus, his birth anniversary and reflection on his exemplary life opens our minds, sharpens our insight, uplifts our hearts, refreshes our souls, strengthens our spirit, and firms up our faith with renewed fervor for availing of the showers of mercy that our loving Creator sends down in Rajab for those striving towards divine favors and forgiveness. It would be repetitive to say that Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, had the honor of lineal descent from the Prophet of Islam on both sides, his father Imam Zainul Abidin being the son of Prophet's younger grandson Imam Hussein, and his mother Fatima being the daughter of the Prophet's elder grandson Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace upon them all. Here is one of the famous sayings of the fifth Imam on the austerity of his ancestor, the Prophet. Islam is a firm and decisive faith. Scale its heights, but calmly. Don't put excessive weight of prayer on your bodies. Do not be like a rider who tires his animal by traveling more than it possibly can. It may fail to carry you to your destination. Satan has misguided some of our people and made them abstain from meat and other delicacies. Such abstention is against the Sharia. Imam Baqir, peace upon him, thus encouraged people to marry, raise children, and cater to their needs in a lawful and legal manner, but at the same time, fulfill their duties towards Allah, the All-Merciful Creator. On his authority, the ayahs of the Noble Quran were explained, the legal code of Islam was defined, and accounts of the prophets of the past were penned down. He thus strengthened the foundations of the school of the prophets Ahlul Bayt, which would flower and reach its peak under his son and successor, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, at whose feet over 4,000 scholars and students learned different branches of sciences, ranging from theology and jurisprudence to medicine and astronomy. Imam Baqir, peace upon him, who despite his grooming of scholars, would at times love to toil under the blazing sun of Arabia by personally engaging in farming in order to set the practical example of dignified labor for earning of legal and lawful subsistence, has said the following: "There is no job better than farming, and there is no benefit better than the benefit of farming, because benevolent and malevolent grazing animals and birds benefit from it and prey for the farmer." The 50 mom, whose 19-year mission was cut short at the age of 57 by a fatal dose of poison given on the orders of Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, the self-styled caliph of the usurper Umayyad, used to fully observe the devotions of the sacred month of Rajab, some of which we reproduce here for the benefit of our readers. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, quotes the Prophet as saying, "God Almighty shall forgive all the sins of the person who recites these phrases every day and night throughout the month of Rajab, Sha'ban, and Ramadan. Recite each of the following three times: Surah Hamd, Ayatul Kursi, the Surahs Kafirun, Tawheed, Falaq, and Nas. Then say thrice, Subhanallah, Walhamdulillah, Wala ilaha illallah, Wallahu Akbar, Wala hawla wala quwwata illa billah, which means, glory be to Allah. All praise belongs to Allah. There is no God except Allah. And Allah is greater. There is no power or force except what derives from Allah, the Exalted and Almighty. Then say each of the following thrice: Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Meaning, O Allah, bless Muhammad and the progeny of Muhammad. Allahumma ghfir lil mu'minina wal mu'minat. Meaning, it means, O Allah, forgive the faithful men and women. Thereafter, say 400 times, Astaghfirullah wa atubu ilay. Meaning, I beseech Allah for forgiveness and turn to Him penitently. According to Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him, the son and successor of Imam Baqir, peace upon him, on the authority of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, Allah has exalted this month and given it a stupendous sanctity, taking it upon himself to honor those who fast it. And whoever fasts a single day of the latter part of Rajab, it will save him from the severity of the throes of death, from the horrors encountered after death, and from the torments of the grave. Whoever fasts 2 days of the latter part of this month will cross over with ease the Sirat, the sharper than razor, narrower than hair string bridge over hell that leads to paradise. And whoever fasts 3 days of the latter part of this month will be secure from the torments and calamities of the day of the most terrible calamity and will be granted immunity from hell. A very famous hadith says a person who recites in Rajab, Astaghfirullah wa atubu ilay, 70 times in the morning and 70 times in the evening, and thereafter raising his hands saying, Allahumma ghfir li wa tub alayya, should he or she die during Rajab, God shall be pleased with him or her, and hellfire shall not touch him or her. The prophet also said, God Almighty forgives all the sins of a person who offers 10 rak'at of the ritual prayer during one of the nights of Rajab, reciting Surah Hamd and Surah Kafirun once and Surah Tawheed thrice in each rak'at. Imam Baqir, peace upon him, groomed several scholars to become the leading lights of Islam. Names of some of these immortals that come to mind are Zurare bin Ayan, the master theologian, Muhammad ibn Muslim ibn Riyaz, the eminent jurist, Fuzail ibn Yasar, the exegete, Ma'ruf ibn Kharuba, the hadith compiler, Buraid al-Ajli, the rhetorician, and Abu Bastir Laith al-Bakhtari, the famous traditionist. These six scholars were known in their times as the tent pegs of the world. There was also Abu Hamza Thomali, who held an esteemed place among the companions of both the fourth and fifth imams. Abu Hamza had conveyed to posterity some moving supplications, including the famous one taught by Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, and recited until this day by the faithful before Sahar or late midnight in the fasting month of Ramadan. Among the fifth Imam's companions was also the renowned poet and master of Arabic literature, Kumayt ibn Ziyad al-Asadi, whose panegyrics titled Al-Hashemiyat are still recited to this day. In conclusion, here are two mind-stimulating statements from Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him, for us to ponder upon. The exterior of the world is very attractive, and in fact, it is very destructive. It looks pretty like a snake, soft and cuddly, but its nature is venomous. The wise keeps an eye on its venom and escape from it. The gullible plays with it like a child. A seeker of the world is like the sheep that ventures into the grasslands to graze. It fattens, and the same fattening becomes the cause of its death under the butcher's knife. Remember, when you appear before Allah, you will have to answer four questions. How did you spend your youth? What work you did during your lifetime? From where did you acquire wealth? Where did you spend your wealth? So prepare your replies to these questions.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the surveillance software deal worth millions of dollars between the Israeli regime and the government of Bangladesh. And we shall also look at the latest verdict by the Indian Supreme Court on demonetization, how demonetization affected the economy and its aftermath.
Having used Palestine as a laboratory to test and perfect its surveillance technology, Israel has become a leader in producing illegal surveillance software, threatening the lives of scores of journalists, activists, and politicians. The Zionist regime did not face any legal action even after the Pegasus scandal got leaked. This lack of accountability is not only threatening democracy, political activism, and independent journalism, but also is encouraging the apartheid regime to sell its spyware technology to more countries, with Bangladesh being the latest prey to its nefarious activities. Israel has been using the spyware technology to fulfill its diplomatic objectives. The regime has been doing this in North Africa, Europe, the Middle East, and even in the US. Now is planning to do the same in the South Asian Muslim country of Bangladesh.
Palestine provides a standard example to understand how surveillance software can be used to probe deep into the private lives of the masses, therefore restricting their freedom of expression and crushing their autonomy. Communicating the idea of being watched, demonstrating an omnipotent presence, is a strong form of psychological warfare that the Zionist regime has been using for a long time. Israel has been benefiting from surveillance capitalism and has turned weaponizing technology into a business. The regime is exporting the technology to Europe, Middle East, Africa, and also to South Asian countries. The sales are in most cases in exchange for some incentives and concessions.
Pegasus is the most famous spyware that's been out on the scene. Israel is its key perpetrator, and it's, of course, something which has been used to hack at the privacy of not only individual citizens, but also leaders as well. I mean, Chancellor Merkel is alleged to have been hacked by Pegasus. We've had the Azerbaijani governments, the kind of virtually every government that I've researched out there has had one form or another of usage of this. And it's been around since at least 2016. And it doesn't seem to be getting any less used.
Sales of these spying software has been disrupting political stability, peaceful political transitions, and democratic governments in different countries, in turn affecting the world peace. Some countries that are using these Israeli-manufactured surveillance tools have been undergoing political instability, authoritarianism, and violent political struggles. Bangladesh also seems to have fallen a victim of this wicked Israeli strategy and has recently signed a contract of $12 million to buy spywares from the Zionist regime. The Israeli cyber companies are banned from doing trade deals with Bangladesh, with a fear that the technology may be carried to Pakistan. But in recent years, the sale of spying tools has taken place through a third-party country. There have been reports that the Rapid Action Battalion of Bangladesh received cybersecurity and surveillance training in the UK and two other European countries. The same Rapid Action Battalion has been accused of extrajudicial killings, forced disappearances, and crackdown on the opposition in Bangladesh.
The Zionist regime has been at the forefront of cyber hacking, cyber warfare. It's made an absolute art of becoming arguably one of the world leaders, if not the world leader in this field. The reality is that they've created something called the Be'er Sheva, an entire city in the Negev Desert, which is dedicated to this kind of cyber security development. They have a unit in the Israeli Defense Force called the 8200 Cyber Department, and their job is specifically to pick up young kids, particularly, essentially groom little children to become these kind of cyber whiz kits. And what they do is they take them through a program in the Talpiot program, actually, that's what it's called, the Talpiot program of the IDF's Unit 8200, basically builds up these youngsters, first of all, to become operatives for Mossad and for the intelligence agencies. And once they've used them to whatever extent they require and taken whatever knowledge they have for their own intelligence and offensive imperialistic ambitions in the region, they then pass these people over to make startups.
Proving to be a luring diplomatic currency, Israel is using these spywares to normalize relations and fight the global boycott it has been facing since its illegal creation. Investing very little in formal diplomacy, the Israeli regime works with businessmen and mediators who in turn contact the power brokers in different countries to meet its foreign policy aims. According to reports, the sale of spyware program played a main role for Israel in getting closer to some Arab countries. The same surveillance software helped Israel to develop closer links with some African countries where Israel had been rejected diplomatically since its formation. The identical design is seemingly being used in the Muslim-majority state of Bangladesh. In a step towards fulfilling the diplomatic goals of Tel Aviv, Dhaka dropped the Accept Israel clause from its passport. However, at the same time, the official policy towards Israel has not changed and the political sensitivity remains.
The South Asian Muslim country does not recognize Israel and has no official diplomatic ties with the regime. Bangladesh has barred its residents from visiting the occupied territories of Palestine. The country, however, now seems to contradict its own foreign policy by embarking on surveillance trade deals with the Zionist regime. The transactions between the two have taken place through a third party to conceal the deal. The purchases from 2019 to this year by Bangladeshi military intelligence include mobile phone interception, hacking tools, web intelligence, vehicle-mounted mobile receptor, active monitoring of mobile devices, and other spying services. The government of Bangladesh has accepted purchasing Israeli spyware from mediating countries.
Essentially, what these people are able to do is to hack into any system. Most of the cyber traffic that goes through the world goes through Tel Aviv, goes through Beersheba now, and the reality is that they could technically access any system. That means that, you know, Britain or America or any global powers' nuclear, firing mechanisms and their systems and their codes could all be hacked by these Israeli Mossad agents. So this is hugely concerning, the fact that they can do this. And then the fact that there is no international body really capable of managing or controlling them. There's no oversight. There's no ethics or morality laws internationally which are in place to be able to control this. And as with anything else, technology tends to come first, and the questions of safety, security, ethics, and morality come later. And that's deliberately done. It's done with the connivance of America and the money mafias that run most of the affair there, because they basically are the prime beneficiaries of greater surveillance, of greater access to all information all around the world. And so that's why you see a lack of inertia within international bodies like the United Nations or any other particular body dealing with security and safety of the world.
According to the Home Ministry of Bangladesh, the government has taken the initiative to introduce an integrated lawful interception system to monitor social media and thwart various anti-state and anti-government activities. The government claims to be using it for lawful purposes. However, the ground reports also from some other countries have given a different picture. Nearly all the countries that signed the Abraham Accords were given the Israeli spying system. There's a nexus between the Ministry of Defense and Foreign Affairs of the Zionist regime to sell these spywares in return of getting recognition from different countries. Israel has been offering surveillance assistance to countries for supporting its illegal accreditation. It has been using this spyware diplomacy to even secure votes of some countries in the UN. The sale of this spyware program has also helped Israel to secure a seat in the African Union for 20 years.
Israel has already got a very intricate network of lobby groups, the groups like IPAC in America, and even the Friends of Israel in Britain. They're just two examples of their huge network of lobbyists. These lobby groups have huge money. They're financed and powered by all sorts of folk, perhaps the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and even others. I mean, there's just too many to name. So they get private financing, and they also get state funding from Israel. Israel, of course, gets $4 or $5 billion on the surface from the Americans annually for all these activities it gets up to. But they have a lot more money privately. It's basically limitless. Now, what they do with these lobby groups is they burrow into the political systems of other nations, and gradually the influence becomes more and more powerful, and they buy off people. They have the money to do that. They spy on them, and they'll find information. They might find all sorts of secrets or, you know, immoral things that perhaps sort of politicians have done, corrupt things that they've done, and then they'll use those facts in order to blackmail those politicians around the world. They'll in privately threaten them with exposure if they don't do what they say.
The cyber weapons, being more deadly than the conventional arms, are destroying the peace of the countries, therefore affecting their population. Bangladesh seems to be missing all these important points and thus falling in the hands of the Zionist regime to be used as a pawn for its exploitative policies.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Six years ago, on November 8, 2016, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi appeared on national television informing that all 500 and 1,000 rupee notes will turn invalid by midnight. The move, known as demonetization, was shocking for the country's population, who were forced to form serpentine queues in front of banks to exchange the currency notes. Three main economic objectives of demonetization were listed by the Indian government. They were fighting black money, fake notes, and creating a cashless economy by pushing digital transactions. But it seems that even after 6 years, demonetization has not achieved its targets.
The Indian government claimed that the aim of demonetization was to try to make India a tax-compliant society. Tax compliance leads to higher revenues and lower budget deficits. The money collected as taxes is spent on infrastructure, the social sector, and national development. The Modi government claimed the move will benefit India's poor. But according to a study by the Reserve Bank of India, the introduction of the GST resulted in higher operation costs for small and medium-sized firms and the informal sector, which also includes farm workers and mom-and-pop store owners. A very large part of the informal sector depends on cash transactions for sustenance. The plan of demonetization sucked out a very large amount of cash from the economy, severely impacting everyone in the informal sector as the business got disrupted and the entire supply chain derailed. According to the Indian Goods and Services Tax estimates, about 12 million people immediately got affected by the note ban. Replacement notes also didn't help much, as 3.3 million people permanently lost their livelihoods. From agriculture to constructions to automobiles, the Demonetization Act led to the collapse of several legitimate businesses.
2016 was not the first time when demonetization took place in India. In the year 1946 and 1948, similar measures of banning various currency notes were taken. However, the Reserve Bank of India never supported the measure. Not paying any heed to the apprehensions stated by the Reserve Bank of India, the government went ahead and legislated the withdrawal of legal tender status using its powers under the Union List of the Constitution of India relating to currency, coinage and legal tender. According to statistics provided by the Reserve Bank of India, the Demonetization Act sucked out 86% of the currency in circulation, thus affecting the livelihood of around 482 million people who depended on cash incomes.
At the beginning of 2023, India's Supreme Court upheld the legality of 2016 demonetization move, saying the individual interest must yield to the larger public interest. The reality about public benefiting from the move seems the opposite. Since demonetization, more than 500,000 companies have been shut down and at least 1.5 million people have been rendered jobless. The employment rate fell from 42.59% to 41.45%. The unemployment rate also declined from 7.51% in 2016 to 2017 to 4.66% in 2017 to 2018 because of the shrinking employed force. According to a 2018 report from the Reserve Bank of India, 15.3 trillion rupees of the 15.41 trillion rupees in demonetized banknotes, or approximately 99.3%, were deposited in banks, leading analysts to state that the effort had failed to remove black money from the economy, which happened to be one of the most important aims of demonetization. Fake notes or counterfeit currency notes were to be targeted through demonetization. But according to the RBI data, counterfeit notes continue to be circulated even now. Another major aim of demonetization was creating a cashless economy mostly used by well-to-do people. Digital channels could have been picked up even without this highly disruptive economic move. According to experts, during the first quarter of demonetization, the growth rate of economic activity was lowered by at least 2%, and except in certain areas such as more formalization of the financial system, demonetization has failed to meet its stated goals.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Leo Saldana, an analyst from Bangalore. Welcome to the program, Mr. Saldana. Now, as a result of demonetization in India, more than 500,000 companies were shut down and at least 1.5 million jobs lost. So the question is, what has India gained from this move?
See, recently the Supreme Court went into the question of whether demonetization was actually a legal move. Of course, the majority judgment went in favor of the government, saying that the government was within its rights to do it. But the dissenting opinion of Justice Nagaratna is extraordinary because it actually highlights how it was not only illegal, but totally unnecessary. And that, in a sense, echoes the widespread view held across the country that demonetization was a method in madness. It was the most undemocratic call ever made by any government in post-independent India. We have had reasons to demonetize before, but it was never done as recklessly as it was done now. It was almost done in a way to say that, you know, one man knows better than the rest of the country. And it has had disastrous consequences. The numbers you speak of is largely a conservative estimate. We really don't know how many businesses have been affected. Small and medium enterprise as a sector got wiped out. The trading sector got wiped out. The farming sector got emasculated, I must say, because almost all farming trade that happens is cash trade. And millions of farmers were reduced to poverty. In fact, more recent numbers are coming out, and the government of India has done an extraordinary disservice to the people by blocking any effort to do any surveys. We have something called the National Sample Survey Organization, which periodically does surveys. Their surveys have not come out. Any effort by, I mean, we don't even have a planning commission anymore. We have a propaganda machinery called the Niti Aayog, which basically talks what the Prime Minister wants to be said. So it's a totalitarian system. And as a result, the truth is not possible to assess objectively. What we have is a lot of work that independent economists have done, and it shows the horrific consequences of demonetization. It has, in fact, taken India back by decades.
So, Mr. Saldana, economic experts have repeatedly warned about the consequences of demonetization, and we saw how it affected the common man. So why is the Indian government still adamant and doesn't accept that demonetization was a mistake?
Well, you see, it's the nature of the government. It's a government which does not believe in democracy. Right from the first major policy decision of Prime Minister Modi, which was to promote the complete so-called reform of environmental laws, which was in 2014. He set up a committee for that, and he gave them 3 months to rewrite the environmental laws of India, which we have built over 4 decades. And they did a ash of a job in 3 months, and we had to resist against those moves. But that was indicative of the type of policy changes that were likely to come. For instance, take the goods and services tax, which was meant to be about fair sharing of resources between the states or provinces and the union government, because India is a union of states. We are not a central government-led parliamentary democracy. We are a union of states which governs the country. But that, of course, was forgotten with the goods and services tax, where the way in which it was implemented on the back of demonetization destroyed trading sector, because the GST system collapsed. Contracts were awarded to favorite companies like Infosys, which obviously couldn't do a good job. And then, as if that was not enough, the income tax system was also handed over to Infosys again. And even the income tax collection system collapsed because the softwares didn't work for quite a while, almost 2 years. And then we had the problem of the pandemic when nothing really happened. So we have had a series of crises which have been created by the government quite unnecessarily. There were systems which are working fine, which had been built over decades. But here is a man who wants to say he constructed the country, and no one before him has ever done anything. So when you have a man who comes with such a narrative, which is ludicrous, then what do you expect? There's no argument against such a statement, you know. Like you've seen totalitarian regimes across the world.
Now, Mr. Saldana, recently the dissenting minority judgment of the Indian Supreme Court has regurgitated the issue of the autonomy of the Reserve Bank of India. So is the Reserve Bank of India sufficiently autonomous?
Well, you see, we have a long tradition of the Reserve Bank of India being very, very staunchly autonomous. Like, you know, we have had such great economists like Dr. Manmohan Singh, for instance, and so on. I mean, he became the Prime Minister of India for 2 terms. When they led the bank, even though there were attempts to influence them, they could forestall such influence. Now, that's not the case under Narendra Modi.